A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hi, this is Meg Riley in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and you've joined us for another episode of The View. We'll start by having our regular say hello and then introduce our special guest for today.
Hi, I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford. I'm in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm in Seattle, Washington.
And I'm Michael Tino here in Peekskill, New York.
Well, I'm excited about our guest today. I've known Scott Nakagawa. We met in 1992, I think, right around the time that Oregon was melting down with that horrific ballot initiative. We had Donna Redwing on last week, so it's been kind of old home week. But Scott has just always been a very provocative thinker and made me, in these 25 years, really think about things from a lot of different perspectives. I thought I'd read a little bit of a Facebook post that he made the other day that someone turned into a blog and published. Scott is one of those people who has a salon at his Facebook page, and there's always a really rich and interesting exchange going on. But this is by way of introducing him. The I is Scott, as I read it. So Scott said this: I've spent the past four decades as a community servant and advocate. I've run a food bank, managed clinics for low-income people, served as a tutor in literacy programs, and as an executive in philanthropy. I've organized electoral and community-based campaigns, wrote grants, asked literally thousands of people for donations, and even more than once climbed through the open window of a home to interrupt an act of child abuse in communities so remote that police could never be expected to react in time. My story probably sounds like your story if you're a late middle-aged social justice advocate. The 80s were rough. Over those same years, I've also cultivated a role for myself as a movement intellectual. However small my sphere of influence, however meager my share of knowledge, I share what I know and am coming to know. I read and write, listen and discuss, and make half-baked proposals in hopes of receiving critiques, choosing as I do to view criticism as an ally in my lifelong battle against my own vast ignorance. And Scott goes on in this blog post to talk about how anti-intellectualism is really killing the social justice movement. And so he's often lifting up provocative ideas. Let's start with this one, Scott. What do you think if we paid a little more attention to some of what we could have known? How do you think this moment we're in could be different right now? Like, what do you wish people knew that you've seen them not paying attention to lately in the social justice movement?
Well, most of my work involves, resourcing and supporting grassroots organizations, community-based organizations. You know, I'm a bottom-up person, right? I want to create social change from the bottom up. And I've found over many years now that at that level of organizing and activism, that people are often kind of afraid of power. And because I think they don't quite understand how power works. And, I think that people have a difficult time of assessing where they fit into a very complex society that is filled with flawed institutions that nonetheless provide us with some protection so that we should criticize them but not just discard them. I just think that there's a difficult time that people have in making real assessments. My sense of that, though, is that, to some degree or another, we've always been that way, but that the problem has become particularly acute since the 80s, since the election of Ronald Reagan and the way in which that change, that sea change, the rise of the right, forced progressives into kind of a defensive posture. We became pragmatists and we stopped talking about causation. We started to talk about outcomes and not process. We started to name wins that we really once thought of as compromises. And basically, in the hopes of retaining some ability, some traction to move the kinds of policies and change that we want, we lost track of the story we need to be telling to the communities that we're working in order for them to understand where they fit into systems of power. So, I see it as my role to do that. You know, I don't think of myself as the brightest person that you'll ever meet, but what I do know is how people who are ordinary folks who work in organizations understand and see the world. And so I think of myself as kind of a filter. You know, there's a lot of brilliant stuff out there. I filter out all of the things that I think might confuse people and focus on the things that I think might help them move forward so they can reach for those things on their own.
So it seems to me that a lot of what's called intellectualism is tearing things down. It is not using intellectual capital to build or to imagine and construct. Mm-hmm. Would you share that?
Well, you know, we've been spending a whole lot of time on defense, you know, ever since the 60s, really. And when you're in a defensive posture, criticism is your friend. You know, it helps you to understand your opposition and how to approach it. The problem is that, you know, when criticism becomes all you do, you start to lose track of the need to articulate a forward-moving vision. Right? So we become critics. And particularly now at a time when people are reaching for change and looking for profits, we find ourselves with a deficit of profits.
Yeah, or sometimes very, very vague, like love each other. Mm-hmm. Prophets that don't really help you know how to live particularly well, how to use power. I think that I really agree with you that the understanding of power and how to use power in a compelling way has been. I see a lot of Unitarian Universalists who have a lot of power collectively, a lot of influence, you know, people really with individual power in the world not having a clue how to use it collectively, not having a sense of what we could do together that we can't do individually. How do you think, where have you seen the most successful grassroots movement use power in ways that you found really compelling?
Well, there are a couple of different instances I can name. The first one, though, is a kind of a sad instance of the way that the religious right has, expressed itself as a grassroots movement. One of the things that they do really well that we don't is storytelling. They recognize that the transformation of communities happens at a cultural level and are in their activism also cultural workers. So they work through pre-existing cultural institutions like churches. They infiltrate those institutions when they aren't already present in them. They transform them in ways that make them into vehicles for them to be able to move power and as platforms for profits. So they, for example, took over, you know, local Republican Party organizations all over the country by running stealth candidates for various different kinds of offices and also just by joining up, right, and becoming the critical mass, the most active minority within the party. And by doing that, demonstrated what a small group of people can do if they're determined enough, and captured control of those party organizations and then started to use them to articulate their agenda. So whereas, on our side, we tend to spend a lot of time building community-based organizations and nonprofits. What they did was they decided to simply take over those that already were rooted in communities and that people identified with, and then turn those institutions into vehicles for them to express their political agenda. So that's one really good example. Another one is in the movement for Hawaiian sovereignty, I think. The movement for Hawaiian sovereignty when I was a young person living in Hawaii was mostly articulated as a cultural renaissance. And so you see there's kind of a theme here, right? That cultural renaissance was one of reclaiming and articulating for the public what it meant to be Hawaiian in a context in which Hawaiians had been humiliated and marginalized and politically disenfranchised. And by doing that, basically, we're able to hold a mirror up to the community in which people could see themselves as something other than people living on their knees, but that saw themselves singing and dancing and speaking their own language and articulating a kind of politic that spoke to the deep yearning, the longing that people had to be able to understand themselves separate and apart from the gaze of the colonizer. And by doing that, we're able to actually build a political movement that now is one of the most influential political movements in Hawaii, and certainly in the Native Hawaiian community. Sovereignty organizations are among the most trusted institutions. So in spite of the radical politics, people who even oftentimes think of themselves as culturally conservative nonetheless identify with those institutions because that connection was made at that deep cultural level.
I know you spend a lot of time thinking about intersectional politics with race, class, and gender. And we're all living in the horrific wake of intersectional politics of people who are homophobic, misogynistic, and racist. Sounds like they're having a fun meeting where you are right now.
I'm sorry. It is a little bit loud. It's a meeting of very interesting people talking about what to do about Trump.
Good. We'll be happy for you to go back to us and keep us informed. How do you think that we failed at that? As a white woman, I was like, holy crap, I knew white women were racist, but I didn't think they'd vote for somebody who molests their children. How do you see that the failure of intersectionality has really meant just such a loss of momentum for the left? How do you think we could do better communicating intersectionality? Mm-hmm. I know you've been thinking specifically around race and class and how to talk about race with poor white people. I'm really curious about
this. Well, it's kind of a complicated idea, but I am completely, just past and over debates about which is more important, race or class, gender or race, race or gender. All of these different kinds of conversations that deal with gender, race, and class as separate but intersecting phenomena. Right. I actually think that all gender is raced, all race is gendered, class is a gendered and raced experience. And so when you see, for example, what happened in this past election with a minority, but nonetheless the most well-organized minority winning the White House on the basis of a highly, specific and clearly articulated bigoted agenda. I think what you see is people basically reaching for power through a kind of way of talking about the economy and their experiences of being marginalized within the economy through avenues of culture, right? And really addressing it through going down the avenue of gender, going down the avenue of race, and not necessarily talking specifically about capitalism, but basically telling a story about capitalism and their rejection of it. And so, I think that, we waste a lot of time trying to figure out which of those things we should be focusing on more, whether it should be class, which is raced. And so when we talk about class without talking about race or gender, we're really talking about white male class, or talking about race, which if we talk about race without talking about class and talking about gender, we're really talking about middle class male race, right? These kinds of debates need to go away, and that we need to really start to understand that capitalism, which is at the center of all of this, is basically a socially unified whole that articulates itself in the lives of people, in the way we experience freedom or unfreedom, in terms of gender and race and other forms of and other ways we understand ourselves in terms of our identities. So with that, I think that, in terms of talking about race with white people, I think we really need to start to recognize that, first of all, when we talk about white people, we're talking about a large mass of people. And we often talk about them as though they're one person, right? As if they're a monolith. And worse than that, we often talk about them like they're monsters, right? That kind of demonizing and that kind of, singularizing, making something that is complex into a overly simplified whole, has the effect of invisibilizing people and making them feel as though they're being erased. And so when we talk about race and we talk about white people in that way, I think we often make white people who are struggling, who are suffering, who don't feel for whom white privilege is not articulated in terms of economic benefit, we make them feel erased and as if they don't matter. And it invites a kind of a contest, right? Is it race or is it our experience? Why is it that liberal elites seem to be talking about race all the time or gender all the time, but they're not talking about us, right? So, you know, it invites this sort of producerism is what people who study the right wing call it. It's kind of a big word for basically, you know, this whole makers and versus takers meme. This idea that basically liberal elites are giving away the posterity of hardworking white people to minority groups in order to be able to manipulate them, to give them their votes so they can seize power in a way that is against the interests of white working class people, right? So, you know, I think that we need to start to rethink how we talk about race with white people and start to think about what their real issues are and then leverage upward, right? So, you know, when you're talking about poor white people, I worked in Appalachia for, you know, for a while. And, you know, you see the kind of suffering that people are experiencing. That suffering is the result of capitalism, which is a racial formation as much as it is an economic one, right? In fact, I think of it as a cultural formation that articulates itself in terms of economics and gender and race. And so people, you know, need to be able to see that we recognize their suffering and that, and then connect that suffering to a broader system of oppression that also marginalizes people on the basis of gender and race. And that's going to begin, need to begin with generosity. I think a lot of what we see now happening in white anti-racist organizing, for example, begins with the very ungenerous place of talking to people about privilege and overestimating it. Right? When we overestimate privilege, we underestimate racism. So, you know, I think it's incredibly important.
Can you say more about that? When we underestimate privilege, when we overestimate privilege, we underestimate racism. Can you say more about that?
Well, privilege is like permission. It's not the same thing as the power to give it, right? And so when we objectify privilege, which is what I think we do, and we make it into this thing, it's like a club. It hits other people over the head. It's something you have. It's something you own and control, when in fact that's not at all the case. We, you know, exaggerate privilege. And you know, and it starts to become understood to people by people as the same thing as power. When power is distinct, it's something quite different, right? Privilege is bestowed by the powerful on those that it is convenient to bestow privilege upon. So, you know, white people, for example, are raced as they are, including Jews and the Irish who and Southern Italians who were not once white, in order to maintain a majority. And in order for a tiny minority among that majority to exercise power. So the privilege of being white and being therefore excluded from certain kinds of oppression was bestowed upon those people in order to be able to exercise that kind of unjust power. After this election, for example, white Jews who have you know, experienced white privilege, right? Because Jews have been whitened in the United States, European Jews, suddenly in a moment saw that privilege start to evaporate. Because this election was won by the Trump campaign on the basis of an anti-Semitic meme, right? That's the fragility of privilege. You know, it's something that we make much too much of. And when we do that, we underestimate the power that racism gives to those who are bestowing that privilege on people in order to maintain that power.
So I want to jump in with a question. You see a couple weeks ago, the article about doing away with identity politics written by a white man in the New York Times. I don't remember his name. But what was interesting is watching the backlash to that article from, I saw it mostly from women of color pushing back against that. So it sounds like you are speaking to how to work through around with identity politics. So I want to hear more about that. Well, it's not that I want you to pick a side, but do you think Bernie was on the right track in terms of saying, let's not talk about race? Because I know a lot of people are justifiably angry about that.
Well, I guess what I would say to that is all politics is identity politics. When we don't name race, that's still about race, right? Like when I said, you know, when we talk about class, for example, if we just say there are class issues, we're not talking about all people's class issues, right? We're not talking about the class issues that are faced by undocumented workers who live under Jim Crow immigration. We're not talking about the class issues suffered by people who are suffering under mass incarceration, which is Jim Crow criminal justice, right? You know, race is still class in the United States, and all forms of class are raced. And all politics is identity politics. I mean, if we didn't learn that from this election, we learned nothing, right? All politics is identity politics, and identity is the trigger all of the time, because we're all in the process of cultural formation and reproduction, right? We're all creating community together all the time, creating consciousness in the spaces between us, you know, understanding ourselves relative to one another. And the primary way we understand ourselves is through identity. So whether your identity is normative and therefore doesn't need to be spoken in order to be expressed, or it's non-normative, like queers or people of color or women, nonetheless, it informs the way we behave. So anyone who says, you know, we need to stop talking about race is not paying attention to what's really happening around us. You know, the reality is, for example, with labor unions, right? Labor unions for the longest time were racist institutions, explicitly so. And that legacy we still see articulated, right? And the inflexibility of labor unions in dealing with things like, you know, the domestic worker loophole, or the farm worker loophole, where fast-growing parts of our economy, people who are working in home health care and who are domestic workers, people who are farm workers, have been excluded from traditional labor unions. Now we see the real problem with that, right? Where labor is now being threatened with the potential of national right to work. You know, these parts of the workforce that have been unorganized, we've conceded to basically Jim Crow immigration, right? And to mass incarceration. And it is now coming back to bite us. And the consequences are grave.
Within the circles, you know, the very broad circle of those who are not supporters of Trump and feel the need to resist, to do things, there have been, you know, it seems like every day we're seeing another fight about tactics. How do we get the good, you know, from the critique without just freezing and feeling like, okay, we can't, you know, all we're going to do is fight each other. We can't do anything.
Well, you know, I mean, we can't afford to fight each other, right? And at this moment, we are facing something quite different than we have in our politics before. You know, many people are saying, well, it's just more of the same, or maybe it's just a magnifying bad that we've already been experiencing. So they will cite, for example, the number of people deported by the Obama administration, which is a terrible thing, you know, and a crisis for people who are being targeted. But when someone like Trump promises to deport millions, that's a very different thing. It's not just because of the harm that does, the number of people, the magnitude, you know, increase in the harm that's done, but because of the power you need in order to do that. In order to do something like that, you're going to have to eliminate some of the instruments and institutions of democracy that have prevented that from happening so far and make room for authoritarian power, because that's what that takes, right? So when you're faced with something like that, fighting with each other is basically conceding to that power. So we need to figure out how to pivot from, you know, that kind of infighting and recognize that what these folks have done is really remarkable on the right. They have been willing to deal with the kind of ambiguity of coalition building, to accept differences and work together. For example, the Christian right in this election served as kind of kingmakers. You know, they went in the vast overwhelming majority for Trump, who is a vulgar and not at all Christian individual. And so, you know, they did it though, because they were trying to move an agenda that is based on a set of moral principles that they have and also political power seeking, and really endorse him and move people to the polls on his behalf, in spite of the fact that he was everything they despise. You know, that kind of willingness to get along in order to accomplish the greater good, to recognize that what you view as the common good is more important than the sort of individual fights that we have, not to give up on your individual agendas and not to give up on the specificity of our experiences and to bring them to the table, not at all, but to recognize that part of the work is accommodating all of that specificity, all of that diversity, right? And that the world we want is one that is ruled in, at least the world I want, by a plural democracy. And plural democracy requires us to be able to get along with those with whom we disagree, right? Those we have thought of as our enemies belong within the context of a plural democracy. To concede to anything else is to concede to authoritarianism, right? So I would say, you know, we should start to model that now. We should start to practice it now. We need to start to practice democracy in action now in order to condition ourselves to be the kind of people who can lead in a world like that, or we will never have it.
What would you say practically that means? We need to start practicing a pluralistic democracy now. What would that mean?
Well, I think that we need to stop, this is going to sound like a really complicated way of going about this, but I promise you will get somewhere. The side of people who have been, opposed to racism, for example, what it means is that we need to move past anti-racist reductionism. And by that, what I mean is to reduce everything to race, as if race is just hate and harm, right? To recognize that actually what weaponizes racial prejudice is the power of institutions and the force of, you know, real power consolidated within the economy and our political system. And that real power is also having a tremendously negative effect on white people, right? We see these death rates escalating. We see the concentrations of poverty building and expanding. We see what happened in the Rust Belt, the kind of alienation people have experienced. The power to do that was consolidated through race. If people participated in it, well, you know, we all participated in it to one degree or another. We need to have the generosity to look past that idea that those are our enemies and recognize that they are, in fact, not our enemies at all. That the other side of racial demonization is to demonize those who have been mobilized in order to articulate the agendas of the powerful people who benefit from that kind of demonization. When we demonize people, we objectify them. And when we do that, we lose track of how they are actually organizing against us and or being organized against us. And we lose track of the diversity among them. That diversity promises a lot, because when you start to look at it, you start to see points of connection. And you also start to see points of disagreement. So when we talk about right-wing, you know, movements, for example, they're not led by people who are of all of one mind, right? There's a lot of diversity of opinion and differences of belief. When we think of them as being just one giant force that is unified against us, we fail to see the ways in which they actually are in a constant argument with each other, an argument that we could enter into in order to try to exacerbate those decisions and, open our arms to embrace some of the people who would fall over into our side.
How do you think religious voices could move things in a helpful way, progressive religious voices, given the religious fervor that at least some of this movement still holds, although that's not visible particularly right now. But I'm presuming Pence is in charge, and certainly for him, it's a very radical conservative Christian theology that's at work.
Well, the reason why I started laughing is because, we really need, progressive religious people on our side. And I think that for a long time, many of us have rejected that and need to rethink that strategy. I think, what we need to accept is that religion has been a part of human cultures for as long as we've known anything about human cultures, right? Every culture expresses some kind of magical belief system, some kind of spiritual life, some kind of, throughout the course of history, those things get articulated through religion, right? And so it seems to me a very human inclination to reach for that experience, and to deny it, I think, is to try to go upstream against something that actually is potentially our friend. And so for all of you who are, like me, skeptical of institutional religion, I think, we have to remember that those institutions contain people, and those people are going to those institutions to seek community, and that, by rejecting them, we are making sure that they will not be on our side. So, but I do think that we need to start to articulate arguments against what the other side is doing that are rooted in a kind of moral belief system that is relative to and connected to and supports our political agenda. And I think that, you know, one of the ways that we can do that is through, you know, working with our religious partners in order to be able to try to figure out how do we claim these things, right? For years, I worked with the World Council of Churches United States Urban Rural Mission, which was an effort to try to reconcile the institutional church to communities in struggle. And people within that group who come from a Christian tradition would say to me all the time, my God is the God of justice. The promise that my God brings is the promise of wholeness in our humanity, not in the next lifetime, just in the next lifetime, but in this one. And I think that that attitude really, really helps us because people are seeking that kind of wholeness. People feel isolated. People feel like they've been left out and left alone. And, you know, we need to be able to figure out how to embrace them and create a living revolution, one in which people can see themselves not just from election cycle to election cycle, but every day, which means building the kind of cultural cohesion between people that's necessary for them to be able to articulate the values of the movement in everything in their lives all of the time. And religion is one of the ways many people do that. And we need to view that as a completely legitimate articulation of one's you know, way of understanding one's relationship to the world and start to reach out.
Scott, you talked earlier about sort of inserting ourselves in the debates that are happening on the right. And I'm wondering if you see a particular opportunity or place for I'll use the term liberating religious traditions. It's mm-hmm. one that Rebecca Parker brought to us last week on The View. But a particular place for those religious traditions that see themselves as part of work for liberation and justice in inserting themselves in the mm-hmm. in those debates.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, drawing from my experience working with the Urban Rural Mission, you know, one of the things that people would say to me is that the Gospels are the story of Jesus and culture is the story of communities. And those two stories have been at odds with one another too often, right? And so I think one of the things that we need to do is start to articulate, you know, the kind of Christian belief systems in ways that are invite reconciliation with communities. I think that there's the possibility of appealing to the base of the Christian right, even if maybe not so much to the leadership, you know, and to start to, you know, basically talk in terms that people understand about the issues that we represent through our religious partners in order to try to split their base. I think at the leadership level, you know, there are a lot of different things. I think that the Christian right, for example, is not at all necessarily the friend of other elements of the right, particularly paramilitary organizations and others who are articulating more explicit white nationalist agenda. And I think that we need to make that really clear by helping people to understand exactly what that agenda is. You know, there's also, I think, a powerful strain of anti-authoritarianism being expressed on the other side, and that I think that we need to start to talk about what that means. You know, what we saw in this election was a rejection of centrist politics and liberal elitism, right? Both on the right and the left, actually, and a kind of reach for something other than kind of traditional liberal solutions to problems. We saw a rejection also of big government, which is ironic because I think that Trump doesn't necessarily represent the kind of, you know, small government right-wing politic that we've become accustomed to, and authoritarianism, both perceived and real. And so, you know, I think that there are many different currents like that that run through all of the different parts of the right that at the level of the base that I think aren't being answered by the leadership. And so people are basically rejecting and then opting for other, basically, you know, voting in the category other, as opposed to specifically choosing, for the most part, their agenda. You know, we need to keep in mind that Trump only won a minority of the vote, right? Hillary Clinton actually won the plurality, and the majority of votes went to other candidates. And so you know, the fact is that most people did not vote for Trump. Trump won with the electoral majority, which is basically just, you know, about organizing, right? The reality is that most people didn't choose him. And over 60% of people who did didn't think he would win, which suggests that there may be a significant number of those people who are protest voters. And we see already that many of them are starting to experience some buyer's remorse. We need to encourage that kind of buyer's remorse by giving people the opportunity to pivot away from Trump and make that a heroic act, as opposed to force them to play the goat and you know, like, admit with shame what they did, right?
So we have a question from the live audience that are watching right now. Asking for you, and it was my question as well, for you to share concrete examples of coalition building. Where do we start? Because everything you're saying is on point. Where do we begin with reaching out to folks who, as we've learned, aren't on our Facebook feed because they're, you know, divided? So where do we begin? What are some concrete steps?
Well, you know, the problem with coalition building is that, you know, it always has to begin with the kind of coalition of those who are, you know, most clear about where we need to go, right? In this moment, we need to, these are, so trigger warning, these terms are terms that in another generation were weaponized against us, but we need to build both the popular front and the united front, right? So the popular front needs to be the broadest possible coalition. It needs to include moderate Republicans, for example. It needs to include everyone who recognizes the danger of this moment and the kind of authoritarianism that might be expressed through this administration. And that popular front needs to be, you know, as diverse as possible. So it needs to include those who, for example, voted for Trump, but then have decided they don't want to go there anymore, right? That actually were able to overlook his bigotry in order to be able to reject liberalism. And but we also need the united front. And I think that that's one of the places where we can really dig in and start to think about what we need to be doing. We need to articulate what is the politic of this moment? How do we claim a place in the political struggles of this time that isn't just an endorsement of flawed strategies and flawed, you know, kind of institutions. You know, we were forced in this election by history, many of us, or at least this is how I see it, right, to choose Hillary Clinton. I did not wish Hillary Clinton to be president. I chose her because history demanded that we choose somebody other than Trump who had a viable chance of winning. That kind of having to you know, choose the lesser of two evils is a problem in that people recognize that really broadly, right? They recognize that there are no good choices here. And when you force people into that kind of situation, they get angry and they reject, right? So I think that the United Front needs to start to think about, you know, exactly what it is that we represent moving forward. How do we build an alternative to this? How do we capture the, you know, kind of currency and the meaning of this time? I, you know, say this often to people, but neoliberalism is just late capitalism. We're already in the middle of a giant transition. You know, whatever will happen next will not necessarily be just a natural evolution into something better. It could get to be something quite a bit worse. But in fact, we are in a time when many things are changing and many of the kinds of political containers for our aspirations, nation states and, you know, local governments and whatnot are going to have to pivot really, really dramatically. We need to be in there proposing an alternative to what's happening now, because keeping it the same is not going to be a thing that's going to happen regardless, right? It's going to change no matter what. And so the people with the clearest vision of what the alternative should look like are going to win that argument. We need to figure out that what that is within that, you know, United Front coalition. Just to get really specific, in the 80s, when I first got involved with fighting the right, I was one of many people who responded to a very brutal murder in Portland of an Ethiopian student named Mulugeta Sura. He was beaten to death with baseball bats and kicked to death, really, and beaten to death by neo-Nazi skinheads. Those skinheads were part of a much broader neo-Nazi uprising that was happening in the Northwest and around the country at the time. And in order to be able to respond to that situation, we had to build a coalition. The police weren't reporting on this adequately. They weren't responding to the situation by giving us real facts. They were telling us that, in fact, there were no real organized neo-Nazi groups in Portland, that this was just a minor marginal problem. They were drawing false equations between neo-Nazis and those who were opposed to them. And so we recognized that this wasn't going to be a simple matter of, you know, groups getting together and going to law enforcement and demanding a solution, that we needed to build a kind of a movement in the city. And so we basically reached out to everyone who was opposed to neo-Nazi skinhead activity, which was most people, right? Almost everyone, even the tourism board is opposed to there being neo-Nazi political groups running around beating people up in your city because it's really bad for business, right? So we reached out to all of those groups and we built a very broad coalition in order to be able to create the political space within which a smaller group of people could organize themselves to begin to explain what was happening to people, to help them understand why this uprising was occurring and what it meant that in a liberal city like Portland, we had this incredible problem, and connect that to the history of the state as a white supremacist and racially exclusionary state, to the demographics of the state, the way that it attracted waves of white flight from other parts of the country because of the racial exclusionary laws, and then to connect that racial exclusionary laws to the kinds of policies that we have in place now that similarly attract that kind of base for reactionary politics. So, you know, we had to do research, we had to do a bunch of different things, but we couldn't do it without the space of that broad coalition in order to form a committee, basically, that then could do that work. But the committee then deployed what it was creating, the research documents and strategies that it was developing through a lot of different avenues. So we, for example, you know, helped to organize something called People of Faith Against Bigotry that then organized themselves to do education through the pews and to mobilize their people when other groups were attacked, right? So you could do a mass mobilization if somebody's home was attacked or someone was brutalized in the streets or being threatened. And through those actions, people could come together and then see one another, you know, in candlelight vigils and whatnot, who in spaces that they were unaccustomed to and in situation and across differences that they weren't accustomed to working across, and find common cause. So we did that, and we did it through a variety of different avenues. You know, we connected ACT UP to Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. We helped to organize a group called Anti-Racist Action and mobilize them to be able to, work in the alternative music scene where neo-Nazi skinheads were recruiting people and defeat them in by competing for the attention of those at their immediate projected base of support. Right, using the symbols, using the language that they were accustomed to, working with local bands, and trying to build a culture of resistance that was happening in the music scene, where the intimidation of neo-Nazi skinheads was having the effect of a minority ruling a majority. In little ways like that, we pieced it together. You know, by the time we were done, that we were, well on our way, we still hadn't necessarily won any support from the local police. And, some of us who are the more militant members of the group, I was in my 20s at the time and really wanted to just, go hand to hand, were calling for an escalation of tactics. But, calmer people, cooler heads basically prevailed and convinced us that we should organize a major march. It was a March for Dignity and Diversity. And this was one of those times when we called the Popular Front to attention and then mobilize them in the streets. And by doing that and publicizing it in the media, we basically created the room for city leaders like the mayor and members of city council to be able to pivot. So they weren't choosing between this group over here of left-wing anti-racist and this group over here of neo-Nazi fascists, but they could choose another position that allowed them to be able to articulate a position on the part of city leadership that then would open the door to police reform in the city of Portland.
That's really helpful. Really helpful. I know, Scott, that you have to get back to your meeting. I so appreciate your time to be with us. As always, I feel like you just did 2 hours worth of stuff in 45 minutes.
Okay. Thank you for having me in.
Thanks for
very much appreciate this.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, y'all take care.
He's been like that since I met him. We had some questions coming in from viewers that we thought we'd wait and talk about with Scott gone, because as you notice, religion isn't his primary world. He primarily organizes the left, and People of Faith Against Bigotry, which a group that I've worked with out there in Oregon, very strong. I mean, he put that together strategically because it needed to be there, but not because that's his natural home. So somebody asked, and I don't know if this is the same person that said, in my rural red area, folks are mobilizing with fragility being expressed, but this is an opportune moment. And then I think a different person said, I'm in the backwoods and religion here is Bible hate. How do you suggest opening communication in areas such as this? Joanna, you've been in Texas a while. Let's have you start with that one.
Well, actually, I have to say, one of the big things that I learned from you, Meg, when you were sitting in a dentist's chair, I don't know if you remember this, and that is the power of changing the question. And for those who don't know the incident I'm talking to, I believe it was a hygienist who was working on your teeth, and it was starting to veer into some, she was obviously very conservative religiously, and it was starting to veer into that. And
yes, and you, it was the Antichrist.
Yeah.
Which was odd, but anyway, that's where.
And you stopped it by saying, what do you love about your church? And that just changed the conversation. And I think that's a big part is, you know, if it's issues of, you know, like don't dive into the, you know, issues of anti-LGBT or things like that and expect to have a positive outcome. You know, change the conversation. And I would say one of the things that I'm every day I'm trying to make this more and more of a spiritual discipline is to respond to things with loving curiosity. And I got to give kudos to Reverend Jake Morrill, who, if you follow him on Facebook, he has a wide range of friends and you'll see him do this just all the time. You know, this whole idea of an ethic of loving curiosity.
Michael, you've been a gay man for a long time. Certainly we who are queer have experienced what are called the clobber passages of the Bible very directly and personally in our lives. What have you found ever to work?
So, you know, I think that in my experience, useful conversations have often been around, especially with, say, conservative Christian people, for example, I love this idea of curiosity and loving curiosity, but it's sort of like the loving curiosity I have sometimes is what kind of world do you think Jesus would want, right? So your understanding of Jesus's teachings, what kind of world do you think Jesus would build? And I've had some really lovely conversations about that, because it really, I've never heard them referred to as the clobber passages of the Bible, but I know exactly the ones you're talking about, Meg. None of them are ones that Jesus actually said, right? So none of them come from the parables of the Gospels, for example. You know, one or two of them come from Paul. And one or two of them come from the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. So, you know, when we start thinking about, what does it mean to live the lessons of Jesus's parables, for example, it's hard to justify trying to build a society where people are excluded, right? Or where we define who we hate, right? Because it's so, like, not what he was about. So, you know, at least even if we don't agree on what Jesus actually taught in those conversations, they've been interesting conversations that tell someone, hey, this queer Unitarian guy actually thinks about Jesus sometimes. And if that's the only, if that's the lesson I plant in people's brain, then that's okay too.
Yeah. You know, I think going to values, which both of you have said in different ways, is extremely helpful. And in a way, you know, asking someone what they love about their church is asking them about their values. Asking them what they think Jesus would do is asking them about their values. Really, I think stating our values clearly is really helpful. I know with standing on the side of love and just the whole concept of love, what community doesn't think that's their value? Whatever they're doing, that's what they think is their value. So if you can get to a place, and you know, this deep canvassing work is all about getting people to share, you know, their values about what kind of community do you want? What do you think it would look like if we were safe? What do you, you know? And I think what Scott said about separating from leaders from followers is really important, because Sharon Welch, who's a good friend, is always reading all the theory and telling me about it, which I love. I tell her the meetings I go to, and she tells me the books she's read and all the theory, and we're a great pair. And there's a new thing out about, you know, conservative versus progressive values, which quotes Durkheim and all these people. You know, I tried to read it and then said, just tell me about it. But anyway, it basically says one of the values of conservatism is exclusion. And is, for lack of a better word, hate. And so at that point, it's really hard to have a conversation. But I think if you go to parenting or family or, you know, I don't know. I mean, this is something I'm really struggling with. And I'm curious, the person who said that there is fragility and it feels like a moment in your rural community, the red area, what kind of fragility is being expressed? What are people talking about? I haven't heard the kind of remorse that Scott talked about, so I'm clearly not in the right places to be hearing it. So I'd love to know if other people are hearing remorse about what people see now versus what they thought they were like. I'd love to hear about that.
Meg, you bring up values, and no one who knows me is going to be surprised that that I will now reference Dolly Parton. As someone whose theology is decidedly notion that God loves everyone, because that's what she was taught in her evangelical Christian upbringing, that God loves everyone, and so she's been very open about saying God loves gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people. And so that's what I'm called to do. And she says that as someone from the mountains of rural Eastern Tennessee, and not as someone brought up in a liberal religious tradition or in a city or any of these things.
Yeah, I think going to the personal and being willing to listen to someone, you know, I think that's where we go. Is if we can get away from, you know, just statements and opinions. And one of the things, you know, I've said this before, like throw out the elevator speech and give your testimony. And listen to the testimony. You know, this is a thing in evangelical worlds where people will actually say to you, can I give you my testimony? And their testimony is never about creeds or history or even positions. It's here is what this religion has done in my life. And I think that when we listen to those, most of the time we can find something that we can connect with.
I have a one of my friends, white friends from the Northeast. I'm her only Facebook friend who supports Black Lives Matter. And so over the last year, every now and then I'll post something and she'll send me an inbox and say, I don't understand this. Help me understand. You're my only friend who supports this group. So, you know, sometimes she will definitely ask me questions where I'm like in physical pain, but I absolutely stay engaged with her. Because she's definitely trying. And so when she sends a question like, I don't understand white supremacy, I don't see it. So give me an example. And I'm like, I don't know that I can inbox you on Facebook examples of white supremacy if you don't see it. So, however, I do, you know, she's a farmer. She loves animals. So I know she had, you know, there's something, we love dogs. So I try to say, well, here are some articles I would suggest you read. And I see that you adopted another dog. I mean, to keep the relationship, because if I'm her one and only friend out of the few hundred she has, that is, you know, I guess in her mind, radical, I don't want to lose that connection, because then we're in our bubbles, right? And that's not, I think that's part of why we got where we are.
Well, speaking of that, Shauna Foster's asked a couple questions. First, do you feel the left loves a good critique more than they do actually seizing political power? And then as a follow-up, what should we do about that? Clearly, she thinks that. Loving a good critique instead of actually seizing power. How can we move people away from ideological purity towards practical means of changing our world, especially in politics? Well, I think that time's just going to make us do that, you know? I mean, I just think the time's going to just... we're not really gonna, there's not gonna be purity to be found. So we're gonna be grateful for anything we can move. I was last night at the Minneapolis City Council meeting for 4 hours and trying to get them not to add yet more police officers, which didn't happen. They added $2.4 million more to the police budget and $500,000 to community solutions. And listening to them nickel and dime how to get $50,000 for women and $20,000 for youth. And it was sad. It just made me sad to sit there and listen. But, you know, at the same time, they voted to divest in Wells Fargo because of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And they put money, this was ironic to me, they put more money into the civil rights office because there's a rise in hate crimes and they want people to be able to get help. And they're like, we don't know why people aren't reporting them. And I'm like, did you just listen to all those people of color talk about what happens when they call the police? And now you wonder why people aren't reporting hate crimes? Like, what planet do you live on? But time for people to speak was over by then. But I'm writing them letters now to follow up because they're people that I know on a city level. You can get to know the people and they know, oh, there she is again. Yep, she's the one who said this last night. And so for me, building those kinds of relationships with the people who have the votes on my state level, on my city level, you know, I'll do all the petitions and the calls, but, you know, whatever. On that bigger level, I'll do it, but whatever. But personally, my own mode right now is anything that people are doing that has them moving at all is good. To me, the enemy is being in bed with Cheetos, you know, and or alcohol or whatever it is we take to bed with us when we're under the covers. So I'm involved with the vote recount, which a lot of lefties are mad about. It's not perfect. I don't love Jill Stein. And you know what? She's doing a vote recount. I'm right there with her. I'm going to be there with, because 11,000 votes in Michigan when they hadn't even counted the absentee votes, you know, it's a long shot, but it gives me something to do right now that I can fight right now. And as well as, you know, our city, 30 churches have stepped up to be sanctuary churches now. And I mean, there's stuff to do now. And none of it's perfect. None of it's going to solve it. But to me, any little thing we can find is, and working with it, we get to know people, we get to love them and hate them and be in relationship and be irritated by them and all of the human stuff. That to me is how we're going to make it, is connected to one another. Someone want to take this other question that came in?
So I see the question is, do you worry that being, and I'll put this one to you, Meg. Do you worry that being a constant advocate makes policymakers associate ideas with a particular person instead of the general public?
I've never worried about that. I wish. Yeah, that's Meg Riley's idea. I'd love if more you use that kind of power, frankly. I think grassroots movement and momentum is going to be critical to anything we want to have happen right now.
I wonder if that question actually speaks to what, to go full circle, what Scott started with. We're afraid of power. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. The right absolutely loves having cults of personality of who takes a issue and runs with it and becomes the, you know, the point person. But it's an interesting full circle question. It's like, actually, what's wrong with that? I would love to be a so. There goes Aisha Hauser fighting for diversity. Woohoo! You know, or there goes Meg Riley.
Well, that's just Aisha Hauser who thinks that.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, isn't that an interesting, to me, it's like, oh, that's us being afraid of power.
Yeah, or else we misunderstood the question completely. Anyway, it's been lovely to be with y'all. Next week, we have Black Lives of UU coming in. They've always got interesting, compelling stories to tell and things to catch us up on. In the meantime, some people I know are embracing this theology of hopelessness, and if that's working for you, work with it. Whatever keeps you putting one step in front of another, me, I'm mining for hope each morning on Facebook just because I have to. That's me. So, yeah, keep moving. Keep alive. Keep awake. See you next time.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye, all.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.